Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about The Last Duel and Lamb, starting with The Last Duel, which is based on a true story and has a lot of, you know, big name actors in it. It's Ben Affleck and Matt Damon working together again, and they did the script, and Adam Driver. And Julie Comer as, you know, the love interest who is violated and then, you know, sets into, you know, motion the revenge plot. I have so many things I want to say about this movie, Mike, but where do you want to start just in terms of the story?
Well, one of the really promising aspects of a story like this is it is indeed based on an actual case, but bear in mind, an actual case from the 14th century. So how much we actually know, you know, is somewhat limited, obviously, but actually, ironically and providentially, that's an advantage from a screenwriting and directing perspective. You're pretty free with what you can do there. So what happens is when you have a story about, you know, a rape or an alleged rape and how that plays out through the justice system of what it would have been back in the 14th century, that is based on historical fact, but by the same token, they're free to do a lot with that. And quite frankly, to have it play in such a way that an audience watching the film in 2021 constantly is encouraged to think, well, how it played out back then, how it might play out today. So I think that's a given with a lot of period pieces, but I think it's very much front and center here in terms of how a case like this, and so it gets you into issues of certainly gender equity or non-equity, if you will. And that's, I think, one of the main points of interest for us today is, well, gee, how would they handle a case like this so many hundreds of years ago?
Now, it's interesting that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck brought in another screenwriter, Nicole Holofcener, to help them write the female perspective of the screenplay. Now, one thing I wanted to say right away is that it has a Rashomon style of storytelling in which you get the information three times. But, and we should also mention that, you know, in these times, women were property. They weren't, you know, considered, you know, to have equal rights to men. So you kind of need to know that going in, because otherwise everything just seems it seems to unravel in a nonsensical way, unless you realize that this isn't about a rape, it's about a property crime. But it takes a while for that to actually be established. And by the time it gets around to that, you know, you've already seen the story unfold a couple of times, which I thought was a real flaw. And I don't think that they got it right, even though they brought in this woman to help them with the screenplay. I've heard this called, you know, Me Too in medieval times, which I thought was kind of a interesting way of putting it. But honestly, even though it's a Rashomon story where you get three different viewpoints, you see the story unfold three times, honestly, who needs to see a rape scene three times?
You're making a lot of important points. And in fact, specifically, I love Kurosawa's Rashomon. I've used it in courses, of course, and the phrase itself is used in courtrooms, the Rashomon effect. Each spectator, if you will, each participant has a different vantage point. And in film, as somebody gives his or her side of the story, visually that's reinforced. We see it as they see it. And our inclination is to believe what we're seeing, right? So this is how she tells the story or how they tell the story. And that works brilliantly in Kurosawa's film. It is a major flaw in this film, and for a very pragmatic reason. In the Kurosawa film, there is an alleged assault in the forest. And among the participants and among an eyewitness, everybody has a different way of seeing it, if you will. And we see it through their eyes. And it's fascinating because of the high degree of ambiguity. When I watch Rashomon, every time I watch it, sometimes I side more with one character or another, depending on the mood I'm in that day, whatever it is. You can have that effect as you watch the film. The major flaw in Last Duel is that there is very little ambiguity. And what happens is there's a high degree instead of redundancy, where really each of the versions is pretty close to the others. I mean, there are not that many significant differences, and it just seems repetitious. I'll give a very quick example without spoiling anything in terms of what actually happens or we think happens. There's a moment in the incident where there's a woman inside the castle, sort of looking out through the peephole, if you will, and there are two men outside, and they're knocking, and they, you know, one of them is right at the peephole, and, you know, let me in, please help me, this and that. And so in one of the versions, certainly, it's very clearly shown from the outside, two guys on the outside scheming, if you will, to get inside. And in another version, it's told very much visually in terms of the camera placement from the inside. But you know what? The only difference is the camera placement. In one of the tellings, the camera's outside the castle, and the other one, it's inside. But the actual framing of, in terms of who's who and where they are, is identical, basically. It's not like you suddenly learn more in terms of culpability or something. And that's a prime example for me of redundancy. And it really, I think, limits the film because you feel like, I've seen this before, and now I'm getting another version of the same thing. So for me, that was like the biggest drawback in the film. Another point that Marie made that's so important is we tend to think about stories in this period from a vantage point of Arthurian romance, whether set in England, France, wherever. This is actually an anti-romantic picture because it's really not about romance to any great degree. And we can talk about this in more detail. Instead, these relations between men and women are more transactional. And that's why when the rape occurs, or the alleged rape occurs, and then there's a trial, it really plays out as a fight over property rights. And in effect that, you know, she's the property, and in terms of who's going to pay a price or how it's resolved, it's the men actually. And this is something so bizarre from our vantage point that if you want to like prove who's guilty and who's innocent, it's really, of course, among the two men involved specifically, her husband and his former best friend. But the way it's going to play out is that they would fight a duel, and whoever wins the duel wins the case. Now, that's a really weird way from our perspective, like whoever wins the fight, you know, it's in the arena, right? It's one of these big fights, is suddenly declared to be the victor, not only of the fight, but of the legal case. So somehow that proves guilt or innocence there. To us, that's just like downright surreal. But this is, again, how it would have been handled at the time. The physical staging of it is quite convincing. The mental dynamics of it can kind of leave us scratching our heads. But the fact that there have been so many redundant or near redundant scenes leading up to that, my interest in the film was sort of flagging. I was sort of losing interest in the film just because I felt like it just kept returning to the same few situations, and it didn't really build dramatically for me as it should have.
Well, one thing that does raise the stakes is that it's a very superstitious time. So they believed that God was in charge of whoever won the duel. So that was the proof of who was telling the truth, something that's kind of hard to imagine. The other thing that comes out is that they believed that pregnancy only could occur if the woman enjoyed the act. So that comes up a couple of times. I think I'm with you, though, that returning three times to the same scene, you really are sitting there thinking, you know, the runtime on this is over 2 hours, and this could have just been edited down so much, just in terms of the one thing that I did see that was different between the three tellings. It starts off with Matt Damon's point of view, and he presents himself, of course, as, you know, this good guy, you know, when he finally marries this woman, you know, on their wedding night, all you really see is him saying to her, you know, you don't need to worry. And that's when, you know, she looks relieved and you realize, oh, I guess, you know, this is a very, you see a lot of, you know, orgies and sexual situations, you know, even before you get to that scene. And you don't see what happens after that, but you do get the sense that, you know, it was a brutal kind of a situation for women back in those days. And of course that unfolds and as the movie unfolds. But I think just for that reason alone, they could have really cut this down to 2 hours. What do you think?
You're absolutely right. You know, you're so right about this, Marie, because the film has a running time of 152 minutes. And yet if you could somehow, let's put it in really severe terms. If you simply cut out the Rashomon structure and just told it as a linear story, it could be a linear story with some flashbacks. As people are talking about what happened or allegedly happened, you could have a quick flashback that way from whoever's point. It could be God's point of view, if you will, since God is sort of overseeing the courtroom here. However, whether it's the God's view or just simply a limited character view, you could work a few of those into it in such a way that you don't suddenly have 10 or 15 minutes at a time devoted to somebody's version of the story. That would have worked really, really well. I just thought that the Rashomon structure probably conceptually struck somebody as a good idea. And because you have several screenwriters, maybe it's too many cooks in the kitchen where you're sitting around the conference table saying, Rashomon, oh, I love that movie, and we should do that. And you know what can happen? And you know, I'm sympathetic here. Once you seize on what sounds like a really good premise, a good idea of using Rashomon, once that you start working with that, I think it's probably hard to go back. You know, I'm getting at it. Just seems like once you start working that in, it's like, oh yeah, and now he'll see it this way and she'll see it that way. But I think only now, as we watch the finished film, we realize you could easily lose 30 to 45 minutes of running time and still have the essence of the story, which is a really solid story. I mean, not just because it's historically based, but just simply in terms of the dynamics of these several main characters jousting in their own way, sometimes literally jousting, and how the legal code worked back then with, you know, if you win the duel, you win the case. And we're thinking, how could that be from a legal perspective? Well, they always invoke God here, you know, that God somehow, you know, is watching over this and will make sure that the innocent party, the good guy, wins, if you will. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, you know, I may be a religious person, but I'm not sure I'm quite willing to go that far with it in terms of who's going to win a duel.
The stakes are raised by the fact that if Matt Damon's character loses the duel, meaning God says Adam Driver's character is telling the truth, the wife also will be killed in a very gruesome manner. So there is that tension where you're thinking, you know, she's the victim. So you watch the whole movie just to see what's going to happen to her. But somehow I think the rest of it just gets completely lost. Now, I did think Adam Driver was a good choice for, you know, the villainous character, because he has the kind of brooding prettiness that works in this kind of role. He seems a little sinister, but what a terrible role for him. I just don't think most people are going to enjoy watching him in this role. Honestly, you have so many bankrollable actors in it, you know, Matt Damon and Adam Driver and Ben Affleck. But it's not a date movie. I wouldn't take a date to this movie. And you can't bring your kids. So who's this movie for, Mike?
I suppose this is a movie for people who go to Renaissance festivals and enjoy the fighting, or to go to medieval times or something. But Marie, you're right. It's not only the grimness of the essential storyline, but actually the grunginess of it, which the film captures really well. I mean, that it was really, you know, muddy. It was not a pretty place in a lot of ways. Think about, you know, the Matt Damon character, when he gets married, it's not exactly the love of his or anyone's life. It's a kind of transactional thing, if you will. And the fact that he's going to have this dispute with his former best friend, and they are, by the end, quite literally jousting for the woman, if you will, the love interest. Again, it's not Hearts and Flowers. It's not Arthurian romance. So it's probably not ideal as a date movie. But one final point along those lines, in terms of being deglamorized, well, a few final points, but one of them being that, you know, Matt Damon is, you know, has always had this, you know, ruggedly handsome appearance, but here he's got a scar on his face. He's got a beard, not that I'm having against beards, but he looks kind of grungy, and he looks like he lives in the 14th century. He's not exactly, you know, the cover of a fashion magazine. And so a lot of the characters, and actually the Adam Driver character, he does come across as the villain for sure. And there is a kind of, you know, charisma to him, but there's always this treacherous, villainous quality. In terms of the overall look of the film, the thing is, it really, really puts you down in the mud, if you will. And I actually, watching the film, became fixated on this point. I don't think there's more than one or two sunny days in medieval France where the story takes place. It's always overcast. It's always bluish gray, if you will. And on the one hand, I've always admired Ridley Scott as a filmmaker. I'd interviewed Scott way back in 1979 when he was doing Alien. And one thing I admired so much about Alien was the production design and how he oversaw that. And in so many of his films, think about his historical films like Gladiator. He's really a master at doing the historical research, at making the film look accurate, look right. He brings all of that to bear here. So even though the film doesn't work for me for the reasons we've cited, looking at it, even though it's not easy to look at sometimes, it's very convincing in terms of, you know, his vision of France. But if anything, ironically for me, he pushes overboard with it. When we got to like one more overcast day and one more, you know, grim scene, I thought enough already. They were pushing it too hard that way. You know, allow the sun to come out for a few minutes, if you will, in this film. And Marie, tell me how you felt about that. Because in terms of the look of the film, yes, it's really convincing, but it's brutally so. It's like punishing to watch it sometimes, just in terms of how overcast and grim it is, the overall look of the film. What do you think?
I did actually think the look of the film was kind of very well done. I mean, I'll at least give Ridley Scott that he knows how to present the picture. But you're right, it is all very dark, literally and figuratively. I wanted to mention something about Matt Damon's beard, though, because he can't grow facial hair. So they had to try out, you know, like 20 different stick-on beards. And he got a rash underneath the beard, very painful apparently. So in between all the takes, you know, he had to sit there with ice packs on his face. And by the way, he, like you said, he looks like 6 miles of bad road. And that beard does not do him any favors. And neither does the story, in my opinion, because I think it's a bad look for Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, who were apparently on good terms with Harvey Weinstein until everything went downhill, to be involved in this movie at all. I just think it was a really, what were they thinking?
Well, Marie, here's an interesting story in terms of a backstory for it. When initially Matt Damon and Ben Affleck got involved in this project, and they initiated as much as anyone a chance to work together, they decided they would not play the two main antagonists. They thought it would be distracting. Like when you have, you know, the female love interest, to the extent that love factors into this story, you have the female interest there, and then you have the two men jousting for. And I think they probably were right about this, that it would be the Matt and Ben show, if you will, if you suddenly had those two tight friends going back so many decades now, suddenly literally jousting, that it would be like celebrity fodder. You know what I mean? That would be distracting that way. So even though Ben Affleck's in it, he plays a character called Count Pierre, who's one of the heavies. And so he's certainly in the film, but I thought it actually worked to the advantage of then having Matt Damon up against Adam Driver. It wouldn't become distracting that way. How do you feel about that? Because I thought actually, you know, when you think about how it might have played out, some people say, well, why didn't they play, you know, each of them play, you know, we have Matt Damon as one of the main characters. Why not have Ben Affleck as the other main male character? But I thought actually that kind of worked for me, the fact that they wouldn't be so directly pitted against each other. How do you feel about that? Because I think that actually works in favor of the storyline as they present it.
I thought that worked too. I thought Ben Affleck with the smaller part in the background with blonde hair was, you know, a surprise. And I agree with you. It would have just been, you know, too much like Good Will Hunting to have them be so in charge of every aspect of the movie, including being the stars. So right on the heels of this, apparently, though, Adam Driver and Ridley Scott went to work immediately on the Gucci movie. So completely different role, but same actor and same director. Are you looking forward to that movie coming out?
Well, one thing I'll say for everyone involved that we've been talking about, there is a versatility here in terms of the kinds of stories that they work on. So actually, for me, it's a bit of a relief that they're getting, you know, I'm thinking of this film now based on what you just said as like Bad Will Hunting. and so actually, I'm just happy that they're doing something completely different the next time out of the gate. And so, sure, I look forward to seeing it. And I hope there are some sunny days in this new film. Just, you know, not that I need hearts and flowers all the time, but sometimes the grimness gets to be a bit much. And that's the downside of Ridley Scott's total control over production design and the look of a film. Sometimes when you go in deep, you just go in maybe too deep that way. And there's a kind of overkill to it visually, I think. I think sometimes you can lighten it up a little bit without necessarily making it lighthearted, which frankly, it's never going to be as a story and shouldn't be. But that you can simply just be a little more versatile with your visual palette. And it wouldn't hurt to have a little more candle power, if you will, in some of the interior scenes, a little bit more sunlight in some of the exterior ones.
Are we missing any aspect of this movie where it might pick up an award?
That's an interesting question. I don't think it's likely to get much awards recognition. For the acting, I don't think so. There are enough other strong performances this year. It will probably pick up some award nominations, at least in visual categories, technical categories, because it is actually well constructed, as you expect from Ridley Scott. So it may get, you know, some token recognition that way. But the reviews and the box office have all been kind of underwhelming. So I don't think this film's going to have much of a, when I say shelf life, I mean in terms of when in the weeks ahead, people start coming up with these lists of best films of the year and nominations and all. I don't think it's going to be near the front of the pack at all, but it might be somewhere in there.
Well, that brings us to our second movie, which is completely different. And it's a movie called Lamb, which is about a lamb-child hybrid. That's really the only way I can describe it. It's an Icelandic movie. So obviously it's set in this stark landscape and they make the most of it, which gives it kind of a folk tale feel. You know, you feel like you're hearing a what transpires is makes no sense, but it works somehow because the setting certainly helps it. And of course, it has a way of introducing some biblical themes. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but the story is it's told like a folktale about this child that is half lamb, half human, that is born on the farm where this childless couple lives in Iceland. Where do we start with Lamb, Mike?
Well, I actually teach a course on Scandinavian cinema, and I include Iceland, which does not often get recognition in an academic context. And so I was actually happy to see it because we don't get that many films from Iceland, obviously. And Marie, your reference about the folktale qualities, Indeed, the New York Times review said that the film, quote, plays like a folktale and thrums like a horror movie, close quote. And when I saw that quote, it reminded me of what happened to me when I saw the film. Walking out of the theater, I overheard a conversation where a few young people had just seen the film, and they were having a discussion as to whether or not it qualifies as a horror film, because it doesn't have all the jump scares and some you expect. It's a very moody, kind of psychologically driven thing. And the strange child itself, herself, they name it Ada, is a combination, very deftly done, of actors and puppets and CGI and you know, various ways in which they make it seem plausible. And they do, actually. You really feel like somehow this you has given birth to something that's not quite human, not quite lamb, and that the childless couple will adopt it, basically, and bring it up. It's a very disturbing, but in a kind of contemplative, kind of quiet way. So when I overheard this conversation, I understood what they were getting at. It's being marketed, or at least by many people assumed to be, a horror film, but it doesn't work, or it's not meant to work in a sort of jump scare way. It's much more brooding and much more, as I say, contemplative. And I found that rather interesting. I mean, I think it's actually, you know, I've not seen a film quite like it, if you will. I haven't seen many films in which, you know, a ewe gives birth to something that's not quite human, not quite lamb. But there's that tender quality of the couple taking to it. But then it gets even more complicated because the two of them are visited by what I'll call the bad sheep brother, this guy who's, you know, not entirely good. So there's some human melodrama worked into it. And I'm not going to spoil at all how it all plays out finally, but just simply the fact that it builds kind of incrementally, let's put it that way. And the reason I think it works so well is what Marie identified. The Icelandic landscape is just really spectacular. And I mean, it's just so beautiful in a really austere way. And the film very deftly places the action there, or what action there is, but it's just really visually striking to watch it. And what I'm saying really is a certain mood is established, and which really held me throughout the film. So it's not something like I would like automatically recommend everyone, or, you know, pitch in that kind of way. But I think if you're in the mood for what's a very unusual film, I think it will definitely hold your interest. I mean, and for me at least, I really felt that I was just totally pulled into that storyline. Very spare, very austere, and I thought quite effective.
Yeah, I was intrigued by this movie the whole way through. And part of it is the scenery that you get to see. It is really beautifully shot. And it also reminded me a little bit of Pig, which we saw a couple months ago and discussed on this show, where, you know, it sort of centers around an animal, but it's really about the people around the star animal and how they're reacting and personifying the animal. Did you see the similarity to Pig?
I did, actually. And I'm always thinking of what I call idealized double features. And I want to have Pig and Lamb play on the same bill. I always have these, like, I always visualize movie theater more keys, and, you know, Pig and Lamb. And yet, you know, joking aside there, you're making good points. Thematically, you can see connections there, because these are films that present animals or near animals in a very favorable light, if you will. And you really get and I sound like I'm joking, but I'm not really. You get a really plausible sense of barnyard life. It's kind of hard to say all this without smiling, but you really do. You really get a sense of what it is to be on a working farm. And what if you do have either an unusual creature or a couple that's, or people who are like really drawn to their animals, not just as a source of income, but the genuine affection for the animals they have. And I thought all that worked, you know, quite well in this film.
Now, do you think that the movie is meant to make a statement about how some people, think of their pets, like their dog or their cat, as a member of the family, not just, you know, an animal, to the extent that, you know, there's entire wardrobes you can buy for your dog, you know, sweaters and pajamas and, you know, even a little teeny tiny tux if they're going to be, you know, a member of your wedding. Is it meant to be a commentary on that?
I think it is, but although I agree with you, there's a tendency to think very sympathetically in a kind of sentimental way about this childless couple. Now they have a child. Admittedly, it's not quite fully human and whatever it is, some sort of hybrid, but they love it and they dress it up and they have it sit at the table and they teach it. They educate it like you would a small child. So all that on a sentimental note. However, on a less sentimental note, a harsher note, this thing, whatever you want to call it, Ada, they call it, was born to a ewe. And the real mother, the actual animal mother, will come under the window, stand on the window and bleat and call out because she wants her child. And I won't say how that plays out, but the fact that, you know, that is kind of heartbreaking in a way that there is an actual natural mother who's had her child ripped from her. That presents our childless human couple in a less sympathetic light so that they can have a child. They have denied a mother her child. I mean, don't you think in a lot of ways, it's a way in which this film is really clear-eyed. In other words, it's not just going to automatically side with this childless couple. It's showing that, well, there are various downsides to the proposition. Number one, you have a very unusual child. What kind of household will this be? Number two, you've taken this child from what would be its natural household.
You also see from other people's perspective, like the brothers, that when it's his point of view, the being looks more like a sheep. And when you're seeing it from the parents' point of view, you see more human qualities, which I thought was very cleverly done. So do you think in terms of the awards that will come out at the end of the year, cinematography and or best foreign film, at least nominated?
Well, Maria, I could see it at least nominated that in that category. It's such an unusual film. Some people might want to vote for it for that reason. Others might just think, a little too weird or a little too marginal, if you will. As to whether, I mean, it would deserve a nomination for cinematography, but we've had a number of films this year that are very well shot. So I don't think that gives it a lock on it whatsoever. And bear in mind, this is, you know, an art film that has a somewhat limited audience. And so in terms of Academy voters, I don't think they're all rushing out to see Lamb, let's put it that way. But people who do see it do talk about it. I mean, you have not seen a film like this, although, you know, Pig is somewhat like it. But, you know, we almost need like a whole separate category of nominations for animal movies like this. These are far removed from the universe of Dr. Doolittle. So I mean, you know, this is really a different realm we're in here. And joking aside, I think that might somewhat limit it in terms of like mainstream award recognition.
All good points. Thank you, Mike. That brings us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.